Welcome to the Tangible Hope Podcast. My name is Willie Elliott, and I'm a professor at the University of Michigan, and my co-host is Melinda Lewis, professor of practice at University of Kansas. Today, we have the great privilege to have Melvin Carter, first African-American mayor of the city of St. Paul in Minnesota. More importantly, for our purposes, he is a person who has given a great deal of thought about how to solve poverty and wealth inequality in America, and has been able to implement several innovative strategies for tackling both of them. And we can learn a lot from him. I think what's exciting is, like, I'm an academic, and so oftentimes we have great theories and thoughts about poverty, but where you've trumped us is that you've also taken those theories and thoughts and implemented them and put them into practice. And so we're excited about hearing more about that. I'm going to ask you a quick first question, and then Melinda really will take over kind of the questioning. But can you tell us a little bit about your story and how you came to think about poverty and why it's important to you and in your work and in your life?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me on this. And, you know, I haven't trumped you at all. As a matter of fact, I don't even use that word anymore. but, you know, as you know well, it all goes together. It all works together. You know, the thought process that you offer for us is something that's really critical. I'm a young person who gets a chance to, I'm just going to keep saying every birthday I have, I'm just going to keep saying I'm a young person and just try to will it into existence. But I
got to say, man, I took that as a little bit of a shot. Like, he said, I'm a young person, which is to say,
no, we all
maybe,
are.
Maybe he's not.
We all are. Oh, I tell folks all the time, young is a state of mind. If you're willing to think differently about stuff, you know what I mean? To me, it's not about how old you are. If you find yourself saying phrases like that's just the way it is, or that's the way it's always been done as a defense against change, then I think you're an old person no matter how many birthdays you have. If you look at things and say, look, I don't like the way that that is, and I'm willing to risk what it looks like to do something different, then that to me feels like youth no matter how old you are. So that's the way I get away with keeping myself in the young person category. But I say all that to say is, I got elected to the city council. So I'm born and raised in this community, went to college in Florida, came back at Florida A&M University, came back home after college, and just try to figure out, like how do I be of use in the world? Started kind of community organizing and started campaigning and started, you know, working on campaigns and things like that, and somewhat accidentally ended up working for my predecessor, the former mayor of our city, and just fell in love with municipal government. The reason I love municipal government is because of the way it's relevant in our lives. The last time the federal government was on shutdown, somebody asked me, is the city shut down too? And I told him, if we were, you'd know it by noon. You wouldn't have to ask, because the things that we do impact people on such an everyday basis. Like, we deal with where our children are going to go after school today, and who's going to show up at our front door if our family experiences the worst. And so I'm a big fan of municipal government. I'm a believer in this theory of, like, municipal government and cities as laboratories for democracy, which means we have to be able to take a risk. We have to be able to try new things. We have to be on the cutting edge. And we have to deliver evidence that our states and our federal government can use to build upon the work that we're doing at the local level. So I've become something of an accidental kind of education / young children leader. Frankly, just because as I was, you know, a 27-year-old new city council member trying to figure out what are all the levers, all of the roads led to young children. And we ended up kind of creating a early childhood initiative in the area that I represented on the city council. And from that, I ended up being I ended up getting named by our former governor, executive director of the Minnesota Children's Cabinet. And that's where I found out about, like, college savings accounts, one of the things that we'll discuss today. I was at a conference, and I've told you this story before. Melinda, our first time chatting with Willie, and he came with Dr. Elliott, as he came on to be our researcher. I was explaining to him why this is so important. And I was telling him, look, research shows that children from low and moderate income families, so at a conference and saw this research that said children with college savings accounts are more likely to go to college. And I laughed. I'm like, that's the most self-selective kind of statistic I think I've ever heard. And then they got more specific and they said, no, children from low and moderate income families who have literally more than $1 set aside for college when they graduate from high school are 3 times more likely to go. And I was explaining that research to Dr. Elliott, and one of our teammates kicked me under the table and I said, what? And he goes, that's his research. And so, like I said, not only have we not trumped you in putting this stuff into action, but we're actually, we figured out what to do because of the thought leadership that you've provided.
thank you for telling us a bit about, you know, your journey and this really empowering, inspirational vision of what municipal government can mean in an age when so many have lost faith that big government can do anything for their families and their families' dreams. Can you help me, though, understand how you pulled in not only the children's savings account, Willie's research has convinced many that that matters, but also a guaranteed income? How do you see those two things coming together? Because truly, that's a divide in some camps. Some folks either want more income into households or more assets. And you, like, really are a leader in saying families need both. Can you tell us about your motivations for pulling both in together?
I don't know that I have anything extraordinary to share, except that, you know, one of the things that I've learned is we pretend when it comes to poor people that the way families work and the way, you know, community operates and, you know, like what families need is suddenly this big mystery. What I know where my family is concerned is we need income and we need to kind of be able to put something aside for the future. I know where my children are concerned. I desire a future for them where they have some income, they have a job or whatever income streams that they have, and they're able to kind of put dollars away to be able to plan for the future. And I know that's what my parents did to help us get to the place where I am right now. And so I don't think any of this is all that complicated. And, you know, we've joked before, Willie, you know, as people kind of get into this, is it income or is it wealth? Is it income or is it savings? My answer is yes. It obviously is both of those things. And when we put ourselves in a space where we're trying to pick one or the other, to me, that's akin to trying to decide if our children need clothes or food next week. It's a false question. And we ought to be thinking about how we do all the things.
I think it's interesting, and let me piggyback one quick thing on that, is to say that it really is, I mean, we're forced as academics to run tests on some of this stuff, but
right,
it is common sense. That's, I mean, like, at the end of the day, right. Like, I mean,
right.
If you don't have income, you're not going to be able to eat. And if you don't have assets, you can't plan for your future. I mean,
that's right.
In a capitalist society, you need income and assets to get ahead. And so we will jump through the hoops and loops to provide the evidence, but we're providing evidence for what we already know, right? We already know this is the reality.
Well, and that's right. And it's one of the things we spend a lot of time talking about. And, you know, I share with my community every chance I get my belief. I used to think a city was a place with a bunch of houses and a bunch of streets and a bunch of bridges and a bunch of parks and stuff. I've come to believe that a city is not a place at all. But a city is a family of people that have to take care of one another. And so where our public safety frame is concerned, if I'm thinking about like this as a family, then saying a public safety frame that, you know, only centers around racing to the scene after something terrible happens, well, that's not good enough for my children. Of course, we have to invest in the community to safeguard our community around them, right? If we're thinking about this as a family, then again, none of us are trying to decide. When it comes to the children who we love, whose names that we know, whose faces we see when we close our eyes at night, none of us are trying to figure out, is it wealth or is it income? It's how do we do all of the things that we, literally every single thing we can imagine to help secure their future. So our challenge and the dare that I keep issuing to our community is, what would it look like to treat a whole city worth of children as though they were children who we really loved and really cared for in the same as we do our own, the children who walk into the door at the end of the school day?
I do say, so I want to say one thing after that also is to say that as I've evolved in my thinking on children's savings accounts, and we really started thinking about them early on as like, it came out of individual development accounts. Mm-hmm. And so the focus was on the individual development accounts, right? Mm. And then when I was trying to figure out kind of how do you produce these kind of small dollar effects you were talking about with a limited amount of money in there, well, one of the things you have to know is that it has to be in the child's name. The child has to know about it, right? So we had a lot of focus on the individual, and that's still relevant and important. But I really have come to talk about these as community accounts, right? So what you've done is put in place a structure for everybody living in St. Paul that not only allows the individual families to save, but when this program really starts to take off, We'll think about employers putting money into those accounts for communities. We'll think about, like they see in New York City, where they're having all the pastors get together for their community and put $1,000 scholarships into the kids' accounts. So these are community accounts.
That's right.
That allow us to begin thinking about planning for our kids' futures, not That's as right. a single family activity, but as a community activity that we all need to participate in. So I think those were spot on words and perfectly said. So thank you for saying that.
Well, that's certainly the goal. I appreciate it. You know, you see the movies about like Serena and Venus Williams and the lore that, you know, they grew up, you know, playing tennis in Compton, and, you know, the rough and tumble guys on the block would protect the block, the tennis courts, because they felt like these young ladies are doing something different, right? I think about like the movie Aquila and the Bee, when, you know, she's trying to figure out who her coach is going to be and realizes she has a whole community of coaches because they see her as doing something different. The question to me, the one of the most profound questions, and Willie, I may have shared this to you before. When I was 17, I had a group of friends who got arrested for stealing cars. And I was so stupid. I looked at them and said, you know, why'd you guys leave me out? Right. And they looked at me and they said, no, you're different. You're doing something different. Like you going over there. And you can't hang out with us when we're starting trouble. We have a lot of history in our community and in our country. The people we look at who go, oh, you know, they're not the ones who we want to be, you know, whatever. Figuring out how to rally around children who we perceive as having an opportunity that we didn't have. So to me, the most exciting question in our work is, what would it look like to take that belief that we had in Venus and Serena Williams, that belief that we had in that young lady, Aquila, that belief that they had in me, and apply it to all of the children born in our city next year? Like, that to me excites me a lot.
Oh, it is exciting. Now I want to see the movie about St. Paul, right? I think that is a story that needs to be told. I guess, really, and I'm interested in either of you chiming in on this. You know, yes, it in a lot of ways feels like common sense. Like, why wouldn't a lower income family need and want the exact same things that anybody would want? But, you know, you're putting your own political, like your reputation, you're spending your political capital on this, and you've got to be able to have something to show the people who don't see it as common sense, who do think about, you know, it. Families and communities in poverty differently than they do themselves. Like, what are you looking at to be able to tell folks these are signs that we're headed in the right direction? This is what it looks like tangibly if every community, every child is loved and supported. Like, what are the returns that you are seeing so that you can then not have to say, trust me, I'm Mayor Carter, and I like have a real good feeling about this, but actually, like, here are the things that are the signs that we're headed in the right direction.
So I'll say two things on that. I want to put these connected, because I do think one of the things, just from hearing Mayor Carter talk, one of the reasons I was excited to have you on this podcast is because you do have a knack and a way for making things understandable to the masses, right? And so sometimes, and I would say, like, the great academics who have really had, so Michael Stratton, for example, he wrote Assets and the Poor. He was on this podcast earlier. And one of the great things about the book was, is not only that it had all kinds of data, but it also talked about it in terms that we could relate to in our everyday lives. So I guess part of what I'm saying is that I don't want to say that they don't see it as it's not that people don't see it as common sense. It's just we haven't conveyed it in a way for them to be able to understand it within their framework, right? And so part of it is upon us to help them understand how this fits into their beliefs around the American dream, for example. So when we say it's a community activity, that's not communism, and right? But it really is about the fact that in order to make the American dream work for everyone, that effort and ability leads to desired outcomes, you have to have an equitable system to where the thing that's left is the effort and ability. The problem we have right now is that the institutions work in such a way that is not about effort and ability, and some people are favored over others. And so really, when we provide these kinds of services to low-income families in particular, we are just leveling the playing field so that it really can be about that. And so my point in saying that is to say that for them to understand, it's not only showing them data, but connecting that data to their fundamental beliefs that will allow them to see that data in a way that helps change the way they behave and act. Now, it's very basic when we, as far as what we're going to show with that. Some of the things are around the idea around tangible hope, right? Why do we talk about tangible hope the way we talk about tangible hope is so that people can understand it. And what's the data is to show that, like, when you're in these kinds of programs, what we've seen consistently is that it raises people's perspectives about the future, where they see that it shouldn't be shocking, and I'll be quiet here, right, to us, because seeing the future, you'll be able to see it more clearly when you have assets, because then you can tangibly begin to plan for it. Like, if I don't have any assets, then all I can think about is today. I'm 54, and I grew up homeless, blah, 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 right? All that stuff everybody knows. And now I work a job that pays me, right? And I'm just getting to a position where I have some assets. And what I want to say about that is that even for me who studied this all these years, it's not over to the last few years. I have a good credit score. I have assets in the bank, right? I mean, how that has changed even how I act and behave and see the world is significant. I mean, I was pondering on the other day, like, even though I've studied this all this time and I think about all this stuff, when you actually get a chance to experience the assets, when you actually get a chance to experience a better credit score, when you trade your car in and they give you money back for it, and you're not upside down into where you're taking out, right? I mean, like, it's fundamentally different way of living a life that is so hard to understand or experience until you've tasted it, until you've been able to. And so these programs, we often say change, we expect the low-income person to change their behavior without giving them access to these things, but I'm not so sure it's possible. You kind of need to experience these things in order to change your behavior to a large degree. And so these programs give them access to institutions that allow them to get assets, to get income, and these kinds of things, right, so that they can have different experiences, so they can see how the world works differently.
That's right.
It was long.
No, but you're really right. Important. And it goes both ways, because it is really hard for somebody who's experienced that privilege, who's experienced those assets, who's experienced that income, to understand the other paradigm as well. I remember in grad school, I had a class called Poverty, Inequality, and Public Policy, and we were in this class, and you know, I remember reading the works of some sociologists who were saying that low-income people are low-income people because they have a present-oriented mindset, and if they just switch to a future-oriented mindset, they would no longer be living in poverty. And I asked my classmates, you know, I said, I don't really think I understand this well. If you could take me outside in a Minnesota winter and just take off your boots and leave your coat and explain it to me outside in the snow, I think I could understand it a little bit better, you know, and nobody signed up to explain it right now. And the point is obvious. When I have a right now emergency, you know, it doesn't help me for you to lecture me about the future. Melinda, as you're talking about like how we do this, I think of it on a couple of levels. You know, one is, you know, you guys are providing us with a significant amount of what we need with the research. So when we're able to say, look at this, you know, and I use the words all the time, it's my big, you know, ace in the hole is, you know, independent third party evaluation, right? And people from a different party love to kind of troll me. And I say, oh, well, show me the independent third party evaluation of your signature initiatives and let's trade. And, you know, nobody's ever taken me up on that challenge. But when we're able to say our college savings accounts initiative has a 9-to-1 return on investment, every $1 that we're investing in it, we as a community, we as a society are getting back a $9 return. When we're able to show the independent evaluation on our guaranteed income pilots around the country, not just in St. Paul, but, you know, I'm one of the founding mayors of this organization called Mayors for Guaranteed Income that since the onset of the pandemic has distributed over $250 million in unconditional cash payments, cash support to thousands of families around the country. And we're able to demonstrate through research that what we thought was true about poverty don't work. It isn't accurate. And I, whoever I'm talking to, I say, look, I don't know you. I don't know where you grew up, but I can guarantee that you had an uncle or a teacher or somebody who told you if you give money to poor people, they'll just go spend it on drugs and alcohol. That poor people are poor people because they're lazy, that they don't know how to manage their money, et cetera. And what we're demonstrating right now through Marriage for a Guaranteed Income is that when low-income people have money, they spend it on their children. They pay the rent and buy groceries and buy clothing. We had one mom who said, oh, I did something irresponsible. And the researcher said, well, what was it? And she said, I took my kids on a vacation, right? We have a mom here who was just telling me last week that her brother got diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, and she wanted to take care of him. And because of our guaranteed income work, she was able to just buy a couch so her brother with cancer could sleep in her house as she took care of him. Those are like basic human dignity type of things. And so to me, I see the research is there, but the stories, if we're willing to understand the folks who we're serving as human beings the same as we're having a human being experience, to me, the stories are even more powerful. The final thing I say is this, and you know, we talked about public safety a little bit earlier. I've got a nephew who was robbed at gunpoint a couple of years back and still has PTSD from that. I tell folks all the time, I'm a mayor who knows what it feels like from a different chapter of life to pawn all your stuff to make rent and still get kicked out anyways, you know? And you've heard this story before, Willie. I have an 18-year-old daughter. When she was born, our family was on WIC, Nutritional Supports for Women, Infants, and Children. And the program has changed and evolved in a lot since then. But then I could go through the grocery store and take out, you know, two tubs of peanut butter, 2 gallons of milk, 2 dozen eggs. You know, we're a family of three at the time. We could get more peanut butter, more milk, or more eggs than we could do anything with. Then we could figure out what to do with. The problem is my daughter was born allergic to milk, allergic to eggs, and with a life-threatening peanut allergy. So we could get all the peanut butter we wanted that would send us to the emergency room, but not one single drop of almond butter that we could actually kind of consume. And same is true with milk and eggs. And so, you know, I have this fundamental belief, Melinda, that when we decide in City Hall, when we decide in the halls of government that we know better what a child needs than that child's parents do, we're not only putting a ceiling on our ability to help, we're actually creating the likelihood that these programs that we're creating with really good intention are actually threatening to harm the same families we serve. And for me, and you know, I think we have a generation of, in particular, mayors, but elected leaders around the country, for whom the threat or the risk of losing a few votes just is laughable in comparison to the risk of leaving things the way we found them.
Willie, what lessons are you sharing from St. Paul that can help to change some of the minds and shrink the distance between assets and income in the places and with the not only elected officials but funders and, you know, and researchers in parts of the country who haven't had yet a chance to experience Mayor Carter's inspirational conveying of those stories personally? Like what about St. Paul and the its contributions to the narrative change that is needed are you particularly sharing?
I think it's a particularly good way to phrase the question, because we're anxiously awaiting August. So in July, we have our last interviewees will be interviewed. And then in August, we'll be able to produce a whole wave of analysis that I think will be fundamental to building upon what Mayor Carter and others have already started. What I mean by that is to say that we'll add data to what we've been promoting about St. Paul. What am I saying in that degree? I'm saying that we're one of the first programs, really the first program that I know of, that said, hey, we're going to take, even with he talked about the mayor's kind of guaranteed income program that was going on. It was, to my knowledge, the only program that joined it to a CSA program. So like they had the foresight from the very beginning to say, hey, we should combine our guaranteed income with the CSA, right? I mean, come on, this is before anybody else is doing this, right? And so that gave me the ability to think about a randomized control trial and get additional funding and stuff with the help of the city, obviously, to do this large test on it. And when we first started doing this test, Like I'm telling people and trying to build the theoretical framework for why we should combine in the narrative, right? Because part of it's just, even when you're dealing with, let's say, quote unquote liberals, the mindset oftentimes is that we need to deal with, if you have a poor starving kid, you got to take care of that starving factor first, and then we'll deal with the assets later. The problem is that it's insufficient, and you never solve poverty that way. We know that from the last 100 years, right? We've been doing income first for however long, and that doesn't work. It doesn't mean that income is not important, which sometimes the asset people can get confused by and get only lost in its only assets. But in the end, Mayor Carter had it right in the very beginning, right? And he gave me the ability, right, the evidence to say that people, that a city is thinking this way, right? It's not just me and my theory and back in the backwoods, but actually they're implementing and thinking this way in the very beginning. That right now, like there's going to be a big guaranteed income conference coming up in June. And one of the things they're including is St. Paul. Why? Because they're going to be the first program to have data out on a combined CSA, right? I can't even begin to tell you how relevant and important that data is to moving this full discussion forward. And these discussions are happening not only in St. Paul, but across the country and also in DC. And so the evidence from St. Paul will be the very first evidence of this kind that will impact everybody in St. Paul and allow Mayor Carter to better do his job there. But it's also going to have a national effect in ways that people are sleeping on in that. But that, the guaranteed income people and others are starting to take real recognition of. And so it's provided me with the ability to speak in ways that I could not have otherwise. I mean, you're actually doing it, right? It's not like, oh, well, because the question becomes, can a city even do this? Can a CSA program be combined with an income program? Can they deliver guaranteed income? Can they deliver all these things? And I can tell them, yeah, don't even try that because we have St. Paul, right? I don't even have to like spend all my time arguing that point. I can just point to St. Paul and move forward. That's a big deal.
I like that. Don't even try that. We have St. Paul.
Right? I mean,
no, it's super exciting. So it feels a little bit unfair, but it's still a question I want to ask. Like, because Mayor Carter, you were the first to think about and to really kind of call the question of why not both? Like, what else is on your agenda for really putting into policy the elements that can make every child feel and truly be as loved as every parent wants their child to be? Like, I just have to imagine that someone who is as innovative in these spaces as you are is not content with just, we have an income program and we have a children's savings account program. What else do you want families, the family of St. Paul, to get?
I appreciate the question. First, I have to tell you, I'm not the first to think about this stuff. I'm an extension of the really, really smart staff who we have in the city who are doing the work on all this type of stuff and who are kind enough to give me memos so I know what to say when I do a call like this. I'm an extension of the community members who demand stuff like this. You know, and the truth is, we're probably actually gaining at least just as much political capital as we're losing, because people in our communities, particularly, especially post-COVID, know that we have to rethink the way that we take care of each other. And I'm an extension of 100 years of grandmothers who have been trying to tell City Hall in St. Paul and whatever city you're in, who've been trying to tell City Hall that there's a whole lot better ways to take care of people in community. And so, you know, and I'm also an extension, frankly, of mayors across the country. As I talk about Mayors for Guaranteed Income, there's, you know, over 150 mayors now that are part of this network. It's really important. When we started college savings accounts, and certainly when we started Guaranteed Income, you know, we joke sometimes that our staff goes to folks in our college savings accounts initiative. Our goal is to start every child born in our city with $50 in a college savings account. I think we're the first city to do this through universal automatic enrollment. And I always tell moms, all that really means is, if you don't want your child to have a college savings account, there's an application to fill out to not have a college savings account, right? Because we really mean all children. And when our staff calls people to say, hey, look, we already put $50 in a college savings account for your child. Or, hey, look, your family qualifies for this guaranteed income pilot in which you're going to receive up to $500 a month for 2 years, no questions asked and no conditions. Or when we say, hey, look, we know you're trying to get your citizenship. We know that's expensive. The city has a zero interest loan program to help you afford the cost of citizenship, because we know you'll be able to be a better participant in our economy when you're on the other side of that. When we say, hey, look, we've eliminated late fines in public libraries and seen our library use skyrocketed. Last year, we got rid of participation fees for youth sports and saw our participation fees and youth sports just skyrocket. Last year was our busiest year on record. The only year that we've ever experienced in St. Paul that even compares to last year was this year, because we're going to break all those records again. And this year, our move this year was to extend free swim lessons for every child in our city. So that's what we're excited about right now. And one other thing I'll tell you is, in St. Paul, we have I-94. Every community that has a freeway has a legacy of somebody who got displaced to build that freeway. And usually those are Black and brown folks. And so we built what's called the Inheritance Fund to tell families whose family inheritance was gutted by losing their home when the freeway came through, that we got up to $110,000 in fully forgivable financing to help them rebuild their family inheritance, rebuild their family wealth through home ownership. I say all that just to say, when our staff calls people to say, hey, we have this program, more often than not, people looking, go, oh yeah, I'm sure, all you need is my mother's maiden name and the last four of my social security number, right? Because they think it's a scam. And it's incredible to me that we're in this space where a scam fits our mental model better than government actually helping people. Like, that's so astounding. And so our point is only, we're only trying to make the point that government actually can be directly relevant in people's lives, that public policies on the local level can actually make our lives like practically better off. We're not just trying to find CEOs to invest in. We're not just trying to find high net worth individuals to get them to move to our city. But the investments that we make are really directly in families like yours. And I'll say, as we talk about saving democracy, I can't, scroll through 10 podcasts without seeing three about saving democracy. I think there's two things to it. I think there's making democracy function, and voting rights are important, and access to the ballots and polling places and things like that are important. But that's making democracy function. Democracy ain't working if my children can't eat. Democracy ain't working if I don't have a place to sleep. Democracy ain't working if I don't have a future to look forward to. So, I frankly believe that this work to help demonstrate how the democratic process can be used to make it easier to feed children and have some place to sleep when it's 20 below outside. I think that's what saving democracy is.
Yeah, I would 100% get behind that one. I think it's almost like the income first question. I think that's if right. You do the part you're saying first, the other part will follow. Like, you'll have the soldiers to produce and change. I say soldiers, people, to make that other change that needs to be done, because they'll buy into it, right? I just totally agree with that.
Willie, is even the haters, like the most vicious stuff that we hear, on Twitter and everywhere, people go, I don't deserve that. What about my family? My family doesn't deserve that. And I always like to point out, that's an argument for more of what we're doing, not less of what we're doing. I don't see that as an argument against what we're doing. You're saying your family would benefit from something like this too. I don't disagree.
No, 100%. And I won't say too much, but I know just from having done interviews that, some of the families will say, like, they're just totally shocked when they're put in the program and it's benefiting them. It changes their whole mindset about it, right? In the beginning, they mentioned, like, I was against that whole idea of a guaranteed income.
That's right.
But now that I have a guaranteed income, the trick of it is people don't want people to get these things, because once they get them, they'll realize that, like, it really is about building equity in the end of the day. It's so your kid has a fighting chance to compete with effort and ability to produce the desired outcome, and not just, have that in theory, but when they have the resources, they have the support of the city, they have the support of the people in the community, then they can really become who they should become, which will only make us better as a country in the end, right? And so, yeah, I mean, you're 100% right on that. But I do want to be mindful of your time, and maybe we can have one more question.
I, for my part, am truly excited about this vision, not just of the two programs and the research that is supporting the pulling of lessons from the programs, but really their positioning within this broader vision of making the city experience and the democratic process itself work in the lives of families. I don't know, it's making me think, Willie, that it's not just about tangible hope, but about real concrete choices that people can have. And the fact that it's, you know, being able to make choices that work for your family today and have a tangible hope of what the future can mean. But I don't know, it seems like rebranding the title of the podcast, Willie, is kind of a pain. But I am, for my part, am bought in to people need to be able to make choices that work for their families today and to have something that they can really tangibly hang their hopes on for the future. So, Willie, the floor is yours to ask whatever last question.
So I want to first mention that I also want to say that the inclusion of financial literacy within the CSA program and what you're doing to kind of the combination with the school district and how the school district can infuse that financial literacy throughout and the incentives that you're providing, will also be the next thing that St. Paul does that the field would look to and say, wow, we can do this. Because there's been attempts at this, but it really has not worked out. But I've had a chance to read some of the materials and how you're going about it. And I think that's going to be something that's really important moving forward. Because one of the things I've also struck me as I aged is that while I know a lot of these things, I was homeless for so long in different periods. I was in poverty. I mean, I didn't go to college until my 30s, right? My master's and stuff. And my point is in saying that is that you don't unlearn those behaviors instantly when you get income and assets. And so there is a need for some financial knowledge. Some people will take that as a slight, as a, like you're somehow, if you say they need financial knowledge, you're blaming it on them. I think you are, if you're not giving them access to institutions and the resources they need, right? But when you combine it, because there is something, thinking about the future, I'm so used to programmed to thinking about the now that it becomes very, I have to think in my mind, okay, you don't have to act that way. You can wait, you can do, right? I mean, if you're in these things for lots and lots of years, you just don't, okay, it's all done. I got money, and therefore now I know how to use it, and I can do everything right with it, and all those things. So I think it's important. My question is, and I don't know if I can ask this question or not, so you can tell me if it's astray. The medical debt relief.
Yeah.
What about that?
I forgot to mention medical debt relief.
I thought that was huge.
That's one of my favorite things that we're doing. So we partnered with the organization called RIP Medical Debt. You're absolutely right. And the truth is, Willie, we have a long history. The only thing you said that I disagree with is we have a long history of financial incentives to change the financial behavior of low-income Americans. It all just works the opposite way. When we create, when we create eligibility criteria that says if you earn more than this, if you earn $500 more, you'll lose $750 in public benefits. Families know that means I can't take a raise or I can't take more hours at work or I can't accept that new job. They know that. When we have, when getting access to higher education means I can't have a college savings account or I can't have any assets or I can't even own a car, the car I need to get to class. Families know that means I gotta stay back here. Because if I try to move forward, the government will move me back. We have a lot of history with negative financial incentives that change the way families operate, which the good news is that's how we know that if we put forward some positive incentives, that it can change the way that families operate as well. So we learned a lot during the pandemic. We learned that if our neighbors don't have access to housing, If our neighbors can't take 2 weeks off of work, if our neighbors can't go straight to the doctor when they think they have symptoms, we're worse off. People have been trying to tell us that for a long time, but we lived it now just in the last couple of years. So we better learn from that. I mentioned briefly our that we eliminated late fines in our libraries. And one of the lessons that we learned is late fines don't do what we thought they do, right? Late fines don't make people bring their library books back. They make people stay away from the library, right? And I've said that in rooms of doctors, and I've said that in, you know, conferences of mayors, and, you know, people kind of laugh, and I take a poll and say, who in here knows what I'm talking about, right? And people always raise their hand and say, yeah, and, you know, that's, when we eliminated late fines in our libraries, literally in the first quarter of that policy. And, you know, the internet is the library's biggest competitor, and libraries have been losing that balance, that challenge. So we're seeing, you know, library use going, you know, steadily down. In the first quarter of that policy, we saw double-digit increases in library use in all of our lowest-income neighborhoods. So it's been and today, as we talk about, like, all of these investments are about believing in our residents enough to invest in them, enough to bet on them. One of the most interesting results of that policy is today, our books are a little bit more likely to be 2 days late, but way less likely to be 2 weeks late. And what we've learned is bring back that book, or else, you know, we're going to, you know, fine you $1.75 a day, was always a less value proposition than bring back that book because your neighbor needs it next, right? And so in the same way, when we realize that residents in our city owe over $100 million in back medical debt, when we realize just if library debt keeps people away from the library, then medical debt keeps people away from the doctor, and people being away from the doctor isn't good enough for us, having learned all the lessons that we learned in the pandemic. And then we also realize, with the help of this organization, RIP Medical Debt, Willie, that private companies buy debt every day for pennies on the dollar, that our residents owing $110 million in old medical debt doesn't necessarily have to be a $110 million problem for our community. So we partnered with them. We're working together right now to spend just over $1 million through which we're going to use to purchase and eliminate over $100 million in medical debt that our residents owe. To me, it's an absolute no-brainer, and it's one of the most exciting things we're doing. You talk about just a return on investment, and I've told, you know, CEOs and private and folks who fashion themselves as fiscal conservatives who don't like the program, I'm going, well, you know, I don't think there's anything more fiscally conservative we can do than get a 100-to-1 return on a public investment that we're making in our residents.
That's outstanding, and it really it also ties into wealth building. Like, if you have all this medical debt, you can't build wealth. I mean, it's affecting you in every way of your life. So I think it's just awesome.
And that goes right back to, like, are we a place or are we a family? Because if I were to tell you, I mean, because you're right, eliminating debt, our value, our wealth is a combination of our assets and our debt. And so eliminating debt increases our wealth. And if I were to tell you that, you know, if we could find $1 million, we could increase the Lewis family's net worth or the Elliott family's net worth by $100 million. I think your first question would be, is it a scam? And if I could convince you that it wasn't, that people have done this all over the country, and, you know, this organization has done this to the tune of billions of dollars, you know, over the past decade or so, we'd all be trying to figure out how fast we can refinance our house, how fast we can liquidate any of our assets. We'd be going after that $1 million no matter what we could do.
100%. So I think that's a great place to stop. I'm really glad we had a chance to mention that. Linda, you want to close us out here?
Yeah, sure. Thank you, Mayor Carter, so much for being here. I've been looking forward to it since I first heard about what's happening in St. Paul, and then reading some of the initial reports and the laying out of these different elements of your not only really inspirational, but proving really impactful investments in families in St. Paul. So truly an honor to get to be a part of the conversation today. And I'm sure a great pleasure for those who get to listen to it. So thank you for being here. Folks who are listening, remember, if you want to make sure that you see and hear future episodes in your own podcast feed, like and subscribe so that you won't miss it. And Willie, I'm sure that you will also make sure that you can convey in August and in the months that come to the audience in this channel and other ways, the exciting news that we know will be coming in the research about the pilots in St. Paul and the effects they're having on families' lives.
Thank you.
Thank you.